Hey, what's going on, everybody? My name is Greg Hall, and welcome to another edition of the Bar Talk Sports Podcasts here on iTunes, Stitcher, and all of your podcasting services. It is the week of January 21st, 2015, the second, maybe third, show of 2015, and we're here to bring you wall-to-wall sports coverage from the NFL, NBA, MLB, and NHL. We're coming off of the conference championships in the NFL, so we're going to run down the conference championship games. We're going to hold off on the Super Bowl prediction. That's going to happen next week when I have Mike Berry back on the show. We're going to talk a little bit about Deflategate and some coaching changes around the NFL, some of the newer ones, not necessarily the ones that happened over a week ago that we kind of touched on last week with Mike. We're going to run down the MLB and the hot stove, the Max Scherzer signing, some big moves by the Angels, the Rangers, James Shields still available. When we go to the NBA, we're going to talk a little bit about Forbes magazine. I'll let you know a little bit more about that a little later in the show. When we get to hockey, we're going to get to the midseason awards and my thoughts on the All-Star game as we have hit the All-Star break. It is coming up this weekend, the All-Star game from Columbus, Ohio. If you are listening to this before the weekend, make sure to tune in to the NHL All-Star Game this weekend. With that being said, you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/BarTalkSportsPodcast, or go ahead and type in Bar Talk Sports Podcast in the search bar on Facebook. You can also follow along on Twitter at BT Sports Podcast. Also, this is very important. Please go over to bartalksports.net. Read all the great content from our football writer, Mike Berry, the hockey and golf writer, James Harding, who's going to be on the show with me tonight, but with unforeseen circumstances, could not. So we'll be flying solo tonight. And also Ryan Waldus, the bartalksports.net baseball writer. We still do need a basketball writer. If you are interested, please go on the Facebook page and either write on the timeline or send a personal message stating that you are interested in writing in basketball, both college and the NBA, for bartalksports.net. I'll be sure to get in touch with you and see what we can do from there. Let's kick it off in the NFL. Two conference championship games, happened this weekend. Green Bay, Seattle, New England, Indianapolis. New England, Indianapolis wasn't necessarily a story for what happened on the field of play. It's for what happened after the fact. New England dominated that game. That was as flat as you can be. If you're Indianapolis, you got walloped last year in the playoffs by them. I mean, Indianapolis can't seem to get over the hump, but they are making progress. So if you're Chuck Pagano, you're sitting there, you were a terrible team, you draft Andrew Luck, you make the playoffs, you get bounced. You make the playoffs and win a game against the Chiefs, then you get bounced. This year, you make the playoffs, win another game, get to the championship game. You win two games, really, and then you make it to the championship game and get bounced. So what does that say? You're progressing. You're not going backwards, much like the Denver Broncos, but we'll get to that possibly at a later date. Maybe next week with Mike, maybe a show after that. Actually, a little bit of breaking news. I am reading that Peyton Manning is actually willing to return pending a physical to the Broncos based on their coaching change, Gary Kubiak going to coach the Broncos. So that is actually some significant news that broke today, just a couple minutes ago, actually. I'm just reading it now. So Peyton Manning, apparently, according to multiple sources, willing to return to the Broncos for another season under Gary Kubiak. So maybe the Broncos aren't heading as backwards as we thought. But again, we'll get into that another time when we have more to break down with free agency, see where Demaryius Thomas goes, if he stays. Same with Julius Thomas. But again, New England dominated Indianapolis. This is a New England team that at the beginning of the year you thought was dead in the water. Brady looked terrible. Belichick looked tired. And then all of a sudden they just turned it on. A team finished 12-4. And then just dominated in the playoffs. They pretty much ran house through the AFC yet again. They had the bye week for, the fifth or sixth time in a row? Fifth or sixth season, in a row. And then basically their two games, they just ran right through them. So I'd like to say that, Let's back up a little bit. The Baltimore game, not necessarily. There was some trickery that needed to be performed in order to. But you have to think they I put this in air quotes, had them just where they wanted, if you will. New England was down much of that game, and they were probably outplayed. So let's back that up. I'll retract that statement. I will say that they squeaked by round one, but they absolutely dominated round two against Indianapolis, or I guess round three, if you will, the conference championship game against Indianapolis. A team that really, from the start, can dominate whenever they want. Aren't you sick of the Patriots winning constantly, everything, all year? But here's the thing. They haven't won a Super Bowl in 10 years since they beat my Eagles. The Patriots only have three Super Bowls in their history, and Tom Brady was the quarterback for all three of them. They've only been to five. Tom Brady's been the quarterback for all five. Now it's going to be six. He is the single, he is the quarterback who's been to the single most amount of Super Bowls in NFL history. Six. He's going to start in six Super Bowls. If he doesn't win against Seattle, spoiler alert, for the when we get over the Green Bay-Seattle game, it's he's still going to have won half of his Super Bowl appearances. Granted, he hasn't won one in 10 years against my Philadelphia Eagles. In the last two he played in, he lost to the same team, the Giants. But this is not the Giants. This is Seattle, a completely different monster. So that's why we're going to hold off predictions till next week. We don't need to go over the games. If you didn't watch them, why are you listening to this podcast? In terms of like quarter by quarter, score by score, just know that Tom Brady hit two linemen for touchdowns. He hit Gronk, as expected, for a touchdown. They do what they want when they want. They're very, you know what, I'd like to say they're very sneaky, but everything they do is planned. You think that that wasn't drawn up that way? You think that they didn't have that planned out from the get-go, from Jump Street to be unorthodox, if you will? That's how you have to win these games. They attacked Indianapolis in a way Indianapolis has never been attacked, unless you count the regular season game where Indianapolis got smoked by New England. So this isn't something new. New England running train over Indianapolis happened already this season. Might have been 2014, but it happened already this season. Now you have LeGarrette Blount doing it as opposed to Jonas Gray, but the same outcome. Big rushing game. Tom Brady managed it perfectly through multiple touchdown passes. And Andrew Luck kind of sputtered. Didn't look great. This is a quarterback who's on the verge of getting a huge contract. Let's not get that, you know, misinterpreted here. He deserves every single penny of it. He is going to be a superstar, and he's lived up to that number one draft status so far in his short time in the NFL. But Tom Brady showed why he is a veteran of 15 years and why he can continue to do this into the future if he wants to. He still has it, and his receiving core is very lackluster. Julian Edelman, of course, a good receiver, a very good possession receiver. Danny Amendola, kind of the same player, but to a lesser extent, like a poor man's Julian Edelman. And then Brandon LaFell. This isn't an exactly like an all-star wide receiver core. So Tom Brady does it anyway. He knows how. And that's what I like about him, but I can't stand the Patriots. I'll be honest. I was rooting for Indianapolis. I wanted Indianapolis to win. And this whole deflate gate that comes out, and you're saying that 11 of the dozen balls were supposedly and allegedly underinflated for this game that came from the Patriots. How did that get by all these people? Yada, yada. Well, guess what? Right now, it's all alleged. So say what you will. I'm not going to formulate an opinion on whether I believe it is true or not. You can do that. Feel free to go off into the comments or write on the Facebook timeline. Do whatever you need to do. Write in the comments section of an article on bartalksports.net. However, it is not fair for me. Unless somebody comes out and says that they did it, that they did it. I am not sitting here pointing fingers, pointing pens, and allegedly saying that this team did it. I will just say that if it is Spygate 2.0 and they were caught cheating again, and it comes out after this podcast is released that they cheated again, you have to. You absolutely have to react swiftly and painfully. They got a first-round pick taken away from them for Spygate. I do it again. Another first-round pick. If they win the Super Bowl and they get the last pick in the draft, it's not going to cripple the franchise. It really isn't. Would you say multiple first-round picks? Would you say Belichick gets a suspension or a lifetime ban? Whatever you want, whatever you think is necessary, that's fine. That's why this is all opinion. But if these 11 of 12 alleged footballs were underinflated and this becomes fact and they became softer, easier to catch, easier to grip, easier to throw, for the Patriots, that is, and Indianapolis was playing from a disadvantage, they still had a chance to put up points. Let's not forget that. They only scored 7 points. New England absolutely dominated this game from a criminally underrated defense. New England's defense is absolutely underrated. Do not forget that. They allowed, what, less than 20 points a game this season. I think it was somewhere in the 19 and a half point range this season. This is a defense that no one gives credit for because historically and statistically over the past, they have not been a great defense. They have not had that recognition. They've been more of an offensive club from quarterback and coach. Guess what? Their defense came to play this season. Their defense is fantastic this season and arguably the reason they are where they are. Yes, Tom Brady came back to life, rose from the dead, but every single team that I can think of that is where they are and has made it to the top, had a good defense, had a spectacular defense, and that's what New England has been doing right now. They have been playing great defense. So whether it is Deflategate or not, Indianapolis only scored 7 points. If this was a touchdown or a field goal game, and there was more on the line later, yeah, I'm sure there would have been more to it. And yeah, I'm sure that if there was some sort of deflation, if this alleged, I guess this alleged cheating actually did occur, then yes, I'm sure it helped Indianapolis from an offensive perspective. But it didn't hurt them or help them from a defensive perspective. Maybe mentally if somebody in the defense knew it, but I doubt that every single man on that 53-man roster knew what was going on with those balls allegedly. Allegedly. So it doesn't take away from your defensive performance. And that is a huge reason, if not the reason, New England is where they are. Brady, Belichick, defense. That's what got them to this Super Bowl, Super Bowl 49, against the Seattle Seahawks. Team who beat Green Bay in overtime, down 19-0 at one point. I think it might even be 16-0 at halftime, maybe 19-0 at halftime. But at one point, down 19-0. You come back. You score 22 unanswered points out of nowhere. Russell Wilson throws 4 interceptions, then comes and has an amazing fourth quarter and a short but amazing overtime session. That 2-point conversion was not Seattle converting it. That was Green Bay giving it up. Russell Wilson just lobbed it. It didn't even reach the end zone. Lobbed it. I think it might have been Clinton Dix, who had 1 or 2 interceptions during the game, had a play on the ball, and also had a play on the receiver, who might have been a tight end, fullback, or lineman. He was a big boy. And he wasn't even in the end zone. Had a chance to make the tackle. Did not do it. Green Bay did not play defense. They blew it. Seattle didn't necessarily come back and win that game. Of course they did, but Green Bay lost that game. That onside kick that bounced right off the helmet, Green Bay had a chance to recover the onside kick. Now, granted, Green Bay and Aaron Rodgers, who was hobbling, came down the field, tied the game as regulation expired. So, yes, they came back, kicked that field goal. Mason Crosby, excellent. Excellent during that game. Wasn't enough. Did send them to overtime, but then Seattle won the opening toss, I think. Maybe they deferred, but whatever. On Seattle's first possession. There you go. Wilson to Curse. Curse with a touchdown catch. The first player in NFL postseason history, in the postseason to have his only catch be a game-winning overtime touchdown. Little random stat for you. But guess what? That's all that counts. Russell Wilson stepped up. And if you want to think of it like garbage time, it was like clutch time. And I will fully admit that I got that from another show. I did not come up with that myself. However, I agree with it. That is absolutely what it was. It was the opposite of junk time. This guy came in the clutch and absolutely came through. He performed. He stepped it up. Aaron Rodgers was clearly hobbled, clearly hurt. You're on the road in Seattle against the quote-unquote 12th man. And you're shutting them out at halftime? You think it's going to be not easy because no game against Seattle is easy, and you don't think Seattle had them right where they wanted them. But Green Bay, this is what did them in. 3 chances early on in that game off of turnovers and off of the opening drive. Green Bay had a chance to score a touchdown. Might have been all off turnovers deep in Seattle territory. And every time, 4th and 1, 4th and inches, 4th and goal, they opted for the field goal. They were up 6-0, could have been 14. That's the game right there. Yeah, of course, the onside kick, the botched 2-point conversion, the obvious overtime touchdown. Of course, they're huge deals. However, you had a chance early to put it away on the road. You decided to take the points, which I can't necessarily say I disagree with because you're on the road in Seattle. Seattle is not an offensive team. They don't score many points. You don't have to score a lot to beat Seattle, but apparently you have to score more than 22. You have to score more than the 6 that you did on the first 2 possessions in Seattle territory where you took the field goal. You have to go for it. You cannot play to lose. You have to play to win, especially on the road against Seattle. And now I am a little hurt by this because I had picked Green Bay and New England in the beginning of the season to go to the Super Bowl. In last week's show, I picked Green Bay and New England to win the divisional games. Or I'm sorry, the conference. I keep saying divisional. The conference championship games to go to the Super Bowl. My colleague, Mike picked Seattle, New England. He nailed it. Great. Kudos and more power to you. I was really, really confident that Green Bay was going to pull this one out. And I was very confident early on in the game when I saw how they were moving the ball, how Russell Wilson looked off. And I had seen Russell Wilson play like this because I watched him against Philadelphia. And when he played the Eagles during the regular season, he was bad with his arm. Yeah, his legs are there. He was working it. But the way he delivered the football, ugly. Ugly, ugly. His passing is not up to snuff. This is a quarterback that is not going to win the game every time on the strength of his arm, on the accuracy of his arm. He's going to move the ball with his legs. He's going to do what he needs to do to get the ball in the end zone. Granted, on that overtime possession, he did throw a couple bombs, and including the one in for the game-winning touchdown. So, yes, he won technically and literally the game with his arm. But 9 times out of 10, he's not going to do that. This is a guy that's a good game manager, very good with his feet, very smart, a very intelligent quarterback. And he was the quarterback on, quite frankly, a worse team on Sunday. Green Bay was a better team. They should have, by every right, won that game. And that is a heart-wrenching, a gut-wrenching loss for Green Bay fans. Now, Green Bay has had a run of success over the past few years, so you're not going to sit there and feel terrible for them. Let's just say you're an Eagle fan. Let's say you're a Cardinal fan. Let's say you're a 49ers fan. You're not going to sit there and feel sorry for Green Bay. They have a Super Bowl championship, something that those other teams I just mentioned came oh so close to getting recently but have not gotten. Oh, and Aaron Rodgers does have a championship. Seattle, very difficult to repeat. Now is going to go up against New England. 2 weeks A week from this Sunday. This Sunday is the Pro Bowl. I'm not even going to touch it because who cares? It is the biggest waste of time. I'm going to cover the NHL All-Star Game in a little bit, or at least my thoughts on All-Star Games in general, maybe, since there are two. Unless the Pro Bowl happens after the Super Bowl now, I don't even care. That's how bad it is. But it used to be the week before the Super Bowl. Probably still is. I don't know. I'll figure it out. However, this whole Deflategate versus the Legion of Boom, I mean, that's what you're really coming down to. And next week when I have Mike on the show, we're going to go through everything. We're going to break down offense, defense, special teams, coaching, X factors, everything you could think of. We're going to get into next week and we're going to break it down, give our predictions, give our scores. We're going to go ahead and give the MVP away or the projected MVP. We're going to do a whole heaping helping of NFL coverage, of Super Bowl 49 coverage for you guys, the fans of the Bar Talk Sports podcast. I'm very excited to do that. To wrap up this week's NFL coverage, however, talk a little bit about the coaching changes in the NFL since last week. There have been two coaching changes that are, more important than other ones since then. This is head coaching only. And then another one that I thought was weird, I'll start with that one, actually, because I didn't do enough research on it. I kind of forgot, so I apologize. Doug Marrone, former head coach of the Buffalo Bills, takes, the offensive coordinator and assistant coach or something like that job with Jacksonville. Not even a lateral move, if you will, a demotion. Did he want to live in Florida? Does he have some ties to Florida? I don't know. That's what I mean. I really wanted to do more research and find out his thought process behind this. I know he wanted out of Buffalo. Maybe he couldn't take the pressures of being an NFL head coach. But you just coached the team to a 9-7 record and almost got them to the playoffs for the first time in 15 years. And then you bolt and take a demotion for one of the worst teams in football who really doesn't have that bright of a future. Just being real. They're going to be bad for a long time, and I don't get it. There has to be some reason, and if it came out as to why, or you're reading as to why, and I'm not saying it, I apologize. Again, I meant to do more research, totally forgot, just kind of wanted to touch on it before I got into John Fox and Gary Kubiak. I mentioned earlier in the show about Gary Kubiak being the new Denver head coach, bringing back Peyton Manning. We'll see what they can do with Demaryius and Julius. They have a couple free agents that are big-time free agents. That team needs to go over something. They got rid of John Fox, who now is the head coach of the Chicago Bears, the other head coaching change that I wanted to touch on. Last week, Mike and I talked about potentially John Fox going to the Bears because it was rumored, but now it is official, and Kubiak is with Denver. Again, any other coaching changes? Yeah, they happened. I did not find them necessary to talk about here because you knew about them. There was no analysis to be done. Kubiak and John Fox. The Bears offense is very intriguing to me with Marshall, with Forte, with Bennett, with Jeffrey, and who knows what the quarterback situation is going to be like. You assume Cutler's probably going to be back unless they draft a quarterback, but that offense has potential to be lights out. So you bring a guy in like John Fox, who just coached a powerhouse of an offensive team in Denver, and in Denver you replace John Fox with Gary Kubiak, who is the offensive coordinator for a Baltimore team that finally, I believe he was, that finally scored a bunch of points. He was a head coach for the Houston Texans when they were in their heyday. He also went through some very, very dark times with Houston, but now coaching in Denver, big gig. So congratulations to both of those guys for landing on their feet. And they are probably the two, with Rex Ryan going to the Bills, the three now with Rex Ryan, and probably Todd Bowles going to the Jets, the four biggest coaching changes of the offseason. A lot of coaching changes this offseason, though. So definitely wanted to touch on that before we switched it over to baseball. And in the baseball world, a bunch of stuff happened. A couple trades that I didn't touch on before. The one trade's a little old news, but I'm going to throw it into, like, when I do it, a little bit of analysis. And I apologize for any background noise. I have a really, really ignorant neighbor living upstairs who just makes a ridiculous amount of noise. So I do apologize if you're picking that up on the mic or you hear any background noise. So it's just my neighbor. So I apologize. That being said, I'll start with the big fish, the big signing, the fresh news. Max Scherzer, big right-handed, arguably the best pitcher on the market this offseason, finally signs. Whew, like the tail end of January, you're signing your contract. It's arguably, it's probably the latest anybody's ever signed of his caliber into the offseason. Signs with the Nationals for 7 years, totaling $210 million after everything. Here is the weird part about this. He's going to get $15 million a year. Well, if you say that doesn't add up to 210, it's because he's going to get $15 million a year over 14 years. That's weird and cool and awesome, and I really like that. He's only going to be under contract with them to play for 7 years, but they're going to pay him for 14. Now, as a Phillies fan, it's going to be nice that some of their payroll every year for the next 7 years after he's gone is still going to be tied up to him. I like that thought because they are not a huge market team. Who knows where this is going to take them, because they're going for it all, believe me. They have the talent to win the World Series. They're a super team right now with the best rotation in baseball, harkening back to the 2011, 2010 Phillies with Halladay, Hamels, Lee Oswalt, and Blanton. Nationals could have a 1-6 and still be the best rotation in baseball. Scherzer now leads a rotation of Max Scherzer, Steven Strasburg, Jordan Zimmermann, Gio Gonzalez, Doug Fister, and then you're forgetting about Tanner Roark, who was fantastic last year, who was phenomenal as a fifth starter. Arguably, it could have been a 3 anywhere else in baseball. Now he gets kicked out to the bullpen to be a swingman, a long guy, and then obviously injury insurance. But this Max Scherzer contract, 7 years, $210 million, $15 million over 14 years, kind of reminds me of, like, the NHL buyouts. I know, because, like, Ilya Brizgalo, for example, for the Flyers, signed a 9-year, 50-some million dollar deal. They bought him out in year 2 of it. And when you buy someone out, if you, let's say, have 7 years left on the deal, well, then you have to pay them over double that period. So the Flyers are going to be paying him for the next almost 15 years not to play for him. That's what kind of this Scherzer contract is like, except obviously you want him to play there. It's $15 million over 14 years. That's something that's really cool. Maybe we'll see more contracts like this in the future. I like it. I don't like it if I were a Nationals fan, because I'm just going to be throwing money out the window 7 years from now for the next 7 years after that. But you are getting your money's worth for those 7 years of Max Scherzer. Handing out 7-year deals, though, to a guy, he's, what is he, 29 now? I think it's going to take him to his age 36, maybe his age 38 season. Yeah, but his delivery, his mechanics are really rough, really raw, really, like, he comes on top of you, comes right down over the top of you, right on the mound. So it's pretty fierce, too. I don't know if he's going to have all those years left in the tank, but he is a Cy Young winner, the best right-handed pitcher on the market, probably the best pitcher on the market, free agent market, that is. Arguably, in the trade market, Cole Hamels up there, you can argue that they're 1 and 1A. And before Lester signed with the Cubs, you can argue that Scherzer and Lester were very comparable. That leaves James Shields unsigned. James Shields is my favorite pitcher in baseball. I'm wearing a James Shields Rays t-shirt as we speak. Then went to the Royals. The Royals happened to be one of my favorite teams anyway. For all of those that you're wondering, yes, I do the show out of Philadelphia, and I am a Philadelphia 5-for-5 guy. That's Eagles, Phillies, Flyers, Sixers, and Union. Philadelphia Union soccer. But If you're wondering, I do obviously have favorite teams in other sports. For example, hockey, I can go on and on about other teams I love. Like Toronto, my number one is obviously the Flyers. Columbus Blue Jackets, Toronto Maple Leafs, St. Louis Blues. Like, they're teams I just love to watch. In football, it's the Eagles and Bills. And I would say the Lions and Bengals I root for, but Eagles and Bills mainly. The NBA, it's really just the Sixers. I don't love the NBA right now because of the superstar-driven factor, and we'll get into the money situation in a little bit when I talk about the NBA after I talk about this baseball stuff. And then in baseball, it's the Phillies, Cubs, Royals, and Rays. They're the teams that I've always liked. They're the teams I will always like. Phillies, obviously, number one going away, far and away. But if you had to tell me, you know, just name a couple of the teams you like. No? Cubs, Rays, and Royals on top of that. So to see James Shields go from the Rays to the Royals was great for me because I still got to watch him all the time. I still got to enjoy him and follow him. And wherever he goes now, I'm going to do the same. He is my favorite pitcher along with Chad Billingsley of all people in Major League Baseball. Hopefully he finds a deal. That would be a good signing for the Phillies, by the way. Chad Billingsley, make that happen. Two straight Tommy John surgeries, that's a low risk, high reward right there if you sign him to a minor league deal. Heck, I don't care if you give him a 1 year major league deal at like $2 million or $1 million with a bunch of incentives. Do that, Ruben Amaro Jr. You need the rotation help. Unlike the Nationals, after the Scherzer signing. But again, Shields, unsigned, where will he go? There's not really a market for him. That's the problem. If you had to ask me, Greg, where do you think James Shields is going to go? I would say 1, San Francisco, 2, San Diego, 3, a return to Kansas City, but at a hometown discount, and I don't see that happening. This is his last big contract. This is his chance to cash in. He wants $100-110 million. Teams are not willing to go that far. You've heard rumors in the past about Miami willing to go 90, maybe up to $95 million for him, but not willing to commit the full 110. But who knows? Only time's going to tell where James Shields goes. So if I had to rank it, it'd be Giants, Padres, and a return to the Royals. You heard it here first, if that does happen. Again, Wednesday, January 21st. Right now, it's 5:58 p.m. Eastern time. So we'll see where that heads up. I'd love to know where James Shields goes. But if you get into a couple more like smaller signings that happened, The Houston Astros are on the verge of signing right-handed pitcher Ryan Vogelsong, have already signed Colby Rasmus to man center field for them. And then they traded for Evan Gattis, big slugger, big right-handed slugger from the Braves. That's good. That's a good week. It's a good couple weeks if you're an Astros fan. The problem with Vogelsong is he is a fourth starter, and Houston does not have a full ace, but they can compete. They are now no longer the laughingstock of baseball. That title does belong to my Philadelphia Phillies. They are going to be the worst team in the majors this year, but Houston, no longer the laughingstock of baseball. When you look at their outfield, Colby Rasmus, Evan Gattis, George Springer, the young phenom. And that's if they play Gattis in left. I would assume they will. They may catch him, but they have Castro for that. DH is taken up by Chris Carter. But again, Chris Carter, Jonathan Singleton, Jose Altuve, Jed Lowry. That's a really good lineup, 1 through 9. It's got some pop. It's got some speed. It's got a little bit of everything, a little small ball. The problem with Houston is the lack of pitching. They don't have much to speak of. When Scott Feldman is your opening day starter or ace with Dallas Keuchel and Colin McHugh and Brett Oberholzer or Dan Straley, Vogelsong, this isn't necessarily a rotation that you fear. And they pretty much all had career years last year. So for them to compete, they're going to have to be better than their career year, which was last year. They got a tough division to contend with. Texas isn't necessarily the team they were a couple years ago, but they're going to be a little bit better. The Angels are obviously going to be the Angels, and the Mariners are a good, solid team, possible playoff team. So Houston's got a long way, a longer way, not as long of a road as the Phillies do, but they're building the right way. If Houston can get some pitching, and they have some in the minors with all the number one draft picks they've had, they have some young pitching coming. So if that all can come together, they can get a little bit more spend heavy. I can definitely see Houston making the playoffs in the next 5 years before the Phillies. I think the Phillies are going to be 5 to 10 years at least before they make the playoffs, before they're even relevant again. So for all you Astros fans, that's looking up. That's some good signings right there. It's a couple good trades so far this offseason for Houston. So I would probably put them actually above Texas, but finishing third in that division this year behind the Angels and Mariners. The last piece of Baseball news. Well, there's two really. One's really not newsworthy. It's more of just a throw-in. But the last piece of news was Yeivani Gallardo traded to those Texas Rangers, the aforementioned Rangers, from the Brewers. But if you ask me, the Texas native was traded just a little bit too late in his career. To me, not necessarily a guy who's going to be a huge high-impact arm for you now. Maybe in 2009, 2010, coming off the big 2008 that he had, he would have been much better. You could have gotten a better prospect package for him. But nevertheless, and my God, I hate my neighbor. Stop moving. Just stop moving. Don't you know I'm busy down here? Stop moving. But Gallardo, a good right-handed pitcher. But remember in baseball, to be a special right-handed pitcher, you have to be just that. You have to be special. You can't just be good enough. You have to be outstanding to stand out. To do that from the right-hand side. If you're a lefty, you can be a little bit more deceptive. You can get away with not having great overpowering stuff and work on being a sneaky guy. But right-hander, you got to have the stuff. And Gallardo used to be a fireball type of pitcher with overwhelming stuff, a crazy delivery. Big force on the mound, but he's kind of tailed off. Some injuries have hurt him a little bit. Still a very good pitcher, probably going to slot in behind Darvish, maybe even be the number two there in Texas. And he is a Texas native. He's going to be a free agent soon, so I'm assuming that's why Milwaukee dealt him. They were so hot last year and then just cooled off immensely, died there at the end, pretty much choked it away. So they found a need to move on. They weren't going to be able to re-sign him. Texas might. If he's a Texas native, he might. And I'm telling you now, watch out for the Houston Astros next year to make a play for Yeivani Gallardo in the free agent market. The last thing I wanted to cover was Cole Hamels, and again, not necessarily newsworthy, but still have to talk about it a little bit. Ruben Amaro Jr., Phillies GM, coming out and saying that he doesn't expect Hamels to be traded, doesn't expect to trade Cole Hamels. Well, we all do. As Phillies fans, as baseball fans, we all do. He's going to waste away as a Philly, not winning, not even contending. And the only reason you don't want to trade him, and I put this in quotes because I really don't believe it whatsoever, not for a second, but the only reason you don't want to trade him is because you want to try to keep attendance somewhat respectable every fifth day. This isn't Steve Carlton in the 70s where you had win day and people would show up when he pitched, but never anytime else. Remember, the Phillies still have Cliff Lee. They have a decent pitching staff and a pretty good bullpen, but no offense whatsoever to speak of. Nowhere for those runs to come from, even in Citizens Bank Park. But Cole Hamels is a wasted asset on a bad team. Your best trade chip you've had arguably in 30 years, and you're going to waste it by saying, I don't want to. Yes, you do. Just like you're going to try and get rid of Howard, just like you can get rid of Chooch, just like you can try to get rid of Utley. You can trade Cole Hamels. You just want the perfect prospect package. You want the top two prospects from any organization. And quite frankly, in this day and age where teams are trying harder more than ever to keep their prospects, they're not going to give up unless it's desperation. So if Hamels does start the season with the Phillies, I will guarantee he won't end it. He will be gone by the trade deadline. There will be a team that needs pitching to make a run. And yes, historically, teams that make the big splash don't win at all. That's actually a thing, but there's always an exception to a rule, and Cole Hamels will eventually be traded. I don't care what Ruben Amaro says. It's as good as done. It's just a matter of when. So stop dragging us along. Get it done. Let's move on. Let's get this new era of Phillies baseball going, because I'm sick and tired of losing the wrong way. I always said I'd trade 10 years of losing for a world championship, and I did that. In 2008, we won one. 2018's coming up in only 3 years, and it looks bleak as hell already. You're losing the wrong way. You're keeping an aging nucleus around. You're not making the trades you needed to. You're starting to this offseason, but you're 3 years too late at least. This is a team that you saw the writing on the wall in 2011. It's over. Stop with the aging core. It's done. So get what you need to get done. Get your you-know-what together. Get this team on the right track, or find a GM that can. Whoa. Shoo. Yeah, that just happened. I just went on that tangent. So let's switch it over a little bit. Let's switch it to basketball. The NBA, Forbes magazine came out recently, and they said that now 11 teams are worth $1 billion. 11 NBA franchises worth $1 billion. Last year at this time, when Forbes released those numbers, it was three. It was the Knicks, Lakers, and Bulls last year at $1 billion. Now, in this order, these are the top 11 teams in the NBA by worth all over $1 billion. The Lakers, the Knicks, the Bulls. So the top three, same as the only three from last year. Now, before I actually finish this list, one team on this list is the Dallas Mavericks. Owner Mark Cuban came out last year and said, when they were estimated to be worth less than $1 billion, said, no, that's wrong. We're worth way more. Turns out he was right, as they are on the list, but they're number 10. Number four, the LA Clippers, followed by the Boston Celtics, followed by the LA Clippers. The Brooklyn Nets come in number six. Number seven, this is the biggest surprise to me, and what I'm very happy about, because this is the team I'm hoping wins it all this year, would be the Golden State Warriors. I'm a big Steph Curry fan, probably my favorite player in the NBA. So, very surprising, though, that a team like that in that market would be valued over $1 billion, especially this high on the list, above teams like Miami Heat, who come in at number 9. Number 8, though, Houston Rockets, again, 9, Miami, 10, Dallas, 11. The perennial winners, the San Antonio Spurs. That's arguably the biggest shocker from a surprise that they aren't higher on the list standpoint. I thought they'd be in the top 5 with all the championships they win, but they're just a team. They don't win by superstar. I love that about them. The NBA is a league of parity. They have the same 5, 6, 7, 8 teams winning it. There's not much of a chance for these bad teams to come in there. You're not going to see an 8 seed make a run to an NBA Finals and win it all. It just doesn't happen that way in basketball. Very top heavy. But a lot of these franchises on this list here aren't good. The Lakers stink. The Knicks stink. Brooklyn stinks. Boston stinks. Miami's not as good. Dallas is kind of fighting right now. So these teams aren't necessarily good in making money. They're just in good markets. The Sixers, for example, are now worth like 3 times what they were a couple years ago when the current ownership bought them. There's like $485 million worth more. I'm sorry, worth like $485 million more than what they were when Harris and company bought the team a few years ago. So NBA stock is on the rise. That's good. That's great. I'm very excited for the NBA. Now make it more of a team-oriented sport. Fix the cap issues. Fix the broken trading system that these teams just... And I do count the Sixers in with that. Fix that. Make it a better product on the court, and I will watch. And I know I'm not the only one who thinks that. I know I'm not the only one who agrees with that sentiment. There are 3,600 people on a former social media site that I ran that would agree with me. Please. Fix that broken product. That's really all I have on the NBA this week. If you have any more you want me to add to the NBA talk or any suggestions for any topics at all, please, again, Bar Talk Sports at Facebook. It's Bar Talk Sports Podcast in the search bar, or Bar Talk Sports Podcast, Facebook.com/Bar Talk Sports Podcast, BT Sports Podcast on Twitter, and obviously BarTalkSports.net. Let's finish the show out right tonight with the NHL, some midseason awards, and my thoughts on the All-Star Game. I'll start with my thoughts on the All-Star Game since it is fast approaching. The All-Star Game is this weekend from Columbus, Ohio. I'm not getting into who's an All-Star and who's not, and who's snubbed and who's this and who's that, because we can go all night about snubs. That actually probably would have been a pretty good topic and something I could have talked for a really long time about. But again, that's such an opinion-based thing between players and stats and all this stuff. If I'm going to bring an opinion into it, I want it to be about something very general, which is just basically my thoughts on the All-Star Game. Is it good? Do I like it? Is it a product that you can get behind? Well, I love the idea of the draft. I think they were the first team to do this. I think the NFL has actually taken it as well and do like a fantasy draft for the All-Star Game or Pro Bowl or whatever you want to call it. And I love that hockey does this. It makes it different. They had the USA versus the world, or North America versus the world at one point, East versus West, Campbell versus whatever. They had it all. Now they have a draft, and I love that. I don't know if it's staged. I don't. I have no idea. You hope it's not. You hope it's not pre-thought out and predetermined. You really do hope that the captains are true in their selections and that these teams really are random, and I love that aspect. I love the thought that my two All-Stars, Claude Giroux and Jake Voracek, could be playing against each other, could be on the same line, could be playing against each other. Very excited to see where this goes and when teammates and brothers even go against each other. For example, in the past, the Sedin twins. Like, I love that thought. So, regardless, I enjoy that. Skills competition, always my favorite part of NHL All-Star Weekend. It's gotten a lot worse over time. It's kind of just, meh. Every single hockey player, every rookie, everyone, the skill level in today's game is just so great. And to use this word, it's just so dirty. All of these kids, all these guys are just amazing talents. Stick handling, shooting, accuracy. So the skills competition is becoming less and less, who's going to win, but just a showcase of guys you already knew were stars. Who's got the fastest shot? Who's got the best accuracy? And you like that aspect of it. But the speed skating, that doesn't do it for me. And the little tiny drills that they do, doesn't do it for me. But if you had to say, hey, what was your favorite part? It's really close between the draft lottery fantasy pick'em thing and the skills competition. The All-Star game is the afterthought. And that's what I kind of want to get into. It's a weekend festivity thing. Even like the NBA does it too. The All-Star game itself is a joke. No one hits. Everyone scores. There's no goaltending. There's no hitting. There's nothing like that. This is more of a casual game. Almost between friends. Almost like a pickup game. Just like the Pro Bowl. Yeah, there's some hitting and stuff like that in the Pro Bowl, but never anything earth-shattering. Same with hockey. You don't want to hurt these guys over the All-Star break when they're not playing for club or country. So, in reality, as a goaltender, I have a little bit of bias because those guys are getting beat up on. But I do enjoy the other things that go along with it. And I'll watch the game, and I'm sure we'll have an adult beverage game going on for every goal scored or something along those lines. It'll be a lot of fun. And I always do enjoy watching those games. It's just when the All-Star game itself is the afterthought, you might want to work the system back a little bit. Maybe bring a little bit more emphasis on the game itself. Maybe tweak the rules or something. Do something that makes it not the afterthought. Because the fantasy draft and skills competition are kick-ass. With that being said, let's wrap up the sports talk for the night with some midseason NHL awards. Just three: the Vezina, the Calder, and the Hart. My opinion for who wins each at the midseason, the halfway point. The Vezina goes to the best goaltender, the Calder to the best rookie, and the Hart to the overall MVP of the league. You're going to love my answers if you live in a particular city in this country. You're going to hate my answers probably if you're anywhere else. The Vezina Trophy, I'm going to start with that. A lot of people have Carey Price. A lot of people have Marc-Andre Fleury. I'm going with Pekka Rinne. And yes, he is injured right now, out for a couple more weeks, maybe even up to a month from now, January 21st. 196 goals against, 931 save percentage. And this is what's mind-blowing, 29 wins. He's already almost up to a 30-win season, and we're halfway home. We're at the All-Star break. This is insane. Guy could win 50 games this year by himself. If he's not the Vezina winner, if those aren't Vezina numbers, I don't know what are. He is the reason Nashville is number two in the West and one of the top three teams in hockey. They are not half that team without him. And they're showing it now with Hutton and Mrazek, or whomever the third goaltender is who's playing backup right now for them. But Carter Hutton's the starter right now for Nashville. And they just lost their first pair of back-to-back games all season. I don't know what else I need to say about Pekka Rinne, and that's why I'm also naming him the Hart Trophy winner right now at this point in time. Injury aside, Tyler Seguin leads the NHL in goals, second in points. Jake Voracek leads the league in points for the Flyers, but those two teams aren't where Nashville is. An MVP is where your team would be without you and how much you've gotten your team to that point. Yeah, the Flyers are not even close to the playoff picture, and Dallas is on the wrong side of it as well. So if Dallas was a top five team, or if the Flyers were in the playoff hunt, I'd probably have those guys ahead of Rinne. They very, very rarely give the Hart to a goaltender. It's like giving the MVP to a pitcher. But I'm going to give my Hart Trophy to Pekka Rinne for the same reasons I just said. So Nashville sweeps those. And by the way, Nashville also sweeps my entire list. The Calder Trophy, this was easy for me. Philippe Forsberg, former Washington Capital, high first-round draft pick, 45 games played, 15 goals, 25 assists, good for 40 points in 45 games, and a plus 24. Playing in all situations for the Predators, playing pretty much every position as well, playing center, playing both wings. The guy is lights out. He's dynamic. He can move up and down the lineup. He's out there for all situations, plays 20 minutes a night, does everything he asks, and he is a breakout star in this league. Nashville, Pekka Rinne and Philippe Forsberg, they are where they are in the standings because of those guys. Now, obviously, they've brought in big pieces like Mike Ribeiro and other complimentary guys, and these two guys are making the team around them better. So Nashville is where they are because of the team, but let's be real. If Pekka Rinne, you told me, was out for the rest of the season, you would think twice about Nashville making the playoffs, much less a top five team, top three team like they are now. You'd actually double take and think, can they make it? There's still a half season left. You don't have Pekka Rinne, 1.96, 931, and 29 wins by himself. That's unreal. But that's going to do it for this week's Bar Talk Sports Podcast. My name is Greg Hall. We ran through everything. Again, if you'd like to follow the show, you can do so. Facebook.com/Bar Talk Sports Podcast. Go ahead and type Bar Talk Sports Podcast up there in the search bar. Go ahead and follow us, BT Sports Podcast on Twitter. BarTalkSports.net, Ryan Waldus, James Harding, Mike Berry, great writers over there. I encourage you to check out their content. I also encourage you to check out The War Room. It's a Philadelphia sports-based site, Facebook.com/War Room Philly, and at War Room Philly on Instagram and Twitter. I don't know if they still have WarRoomPhilly.com or not, but that could be a thing. Try it. Check it out. That's where I got my start. I did that for 3 years before I started to do this show. Go check those guys out if you like Philadelphia-based sports. With that being said, you know where to find us. Tune in next week for my Super Bowl preview. Might have James on next week to talk hockey as well. It's going to be a big show. Can't wait to bring it to you next Wednesday night on iTunes, Stitcher, and all your audio services. Again, thank you, everybody. My name is Greg Hall. Have yourself a great week.